Three, two, one. Log Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Peter Jim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Authority Smashing Hour. I'm going to be doing it alone because David is fulfilling his duty. He's picketing, helping out some of his fellow workers. So I see that no one's on yet, but we have a lot of news to cover. I'm sure you guys have heard that Somalia was just invaded by the United States. It's not the first time this happens in the past decade. It's happened a few times, but Somalia, as you may know, has been the victim of American and European imperialism, and particularly European imperialism, because you know the whole history of Africa is nothing but at least modern history, nothing but meddling on the part of the European powers. And, you know, when we actually look at Somalia and look at what is going on there, we have to have that in mind, that there is a history, and it's so easy for us to look at that country and make the typical imperialistic assumptions. Well, you know, they're a bunch of savages. Well, if you actually look at the history, it turns out that we are the savages. We've been, just take, say, you know, all these claims about piracy. Apparently, a lot of them had to do with people who were just defending themselves against all the toxic waste that was being dumped on the coast of Somalia, which was apparently just decimating, their fishing waters and, poisoning their water. Just horrible stuff. And but it's okay, because there's a bunch of blacks, right? So they're poor blacks, so we don't care. And when Bush invaded Somalia, and when he was in office, that had a very, very dire effect on their economy. So yeah, that's a lot of stuff going on down there. And, their claim to be fighting terrorism, well, I guess we wouldn't allow anybody to bomb the United States to fight the terrorism that is directed from the United States, right? Because, after all, the terrorism that we conduct is thousands of times larger in scale and intensity than that of the Somalis, the Somali pirates, and all the other supposed rogues around the world. Anyway, well, and actually it kind of reminded me to the situation in the early 80s in Afghanistan, where, because what's happening there in Somalia is that you have a government that's been installed by the U.S. It's kind of an unstable, weak government, so they moved in partly to try to keep it in power. And when the Russians invaded Afghanistan, which was actually, I think, 1979, but, officially sort of like early 80s, but, that was the same pretext. It was, we're being attacked, which in fact was true. The Russians had a stronger claim than the U.S., because Afghanistan actually borders the border of the USSR. So, and there was extremism, and of course it was funded by the CIA, but actually, there was sort of a similar situation where you had a government that was installed or supported by the USSR, basically a client state, and it was threatened by other forces within the country, so they moved in to make sure that that wouldn't happen. So, yeah. That's pretty much what's happening down there. But, of course, we have a weaker claim because Somalia does not border the United States. It's not like, oh, man, they're about to invade tomorrow. If the U.S. was interested in stopping terrorism, it would stop its own terrorism, and then it would proceed to, stop exploiting these countries, stop enhancing the threat of subnational terrorism, of course, because our state terrorism we don't call terrorism, but we would just stop the policies that increase terror, and maybe, provide some foreign aid for education, for things, food. That will do much more to stop, bin Laden-style terror than any military operation in the world, really. Anyway, to change subjects now, our wonderful liberal President Obama just keeps confirming so many of the things that radicals and other critics of the system had been saying before he got elected, that he would continue some of the same policies of the Bush administration. So, we just heard that, on top of this invasion of Somalia, of course, that in Afghanistan, in Bagram, which is a detention center which was famous for torture and everything, but he's denying the people there access to courts, to U.S. courts, and many of the people there's no charges leveled against them even, so they don't even have a right to a lawyer or anything like that. It's shameful with all the torture and stuff that's going on too. And Obama has extended the Cuba embargo another year, and the U.S. client state in Pakistan just together with the U.S. Keeps carrying out these attacks, and apparently about 100,000 people were just displaced due to the offensive carried out by the Pakistani government, which, as I said, is like a U.S. client state. They get tons of arms, and just imagine 100,000 Americans were displaced because some government repression operation. I mean, we wouldn't stand for that. And of course, Obama just supported extending many of the provisions of the Patriot Act, and et cetera, et cetera. Not to talk about the Gaza water supply disaster. As in, their water supply is in danger of collapse, and that's not an emergency. Even though most of it has to do with recent attacks fully supported by the United States, and of course a long history of repression of the Palestinians. So that's the picture right there, the picture that the mainstream media doesn't want to tell you about, and that liberals in all these progressive outlets are just not telling you about. They just want to pretend that Obama somehow is not representing an arm of capital, an arm of the American power structure, the elite power structure. But that's who put him in power. The elite put him in power, and he's continuing the policies that he was supposed to carry out. There's no surprise, and I spoke about this, and other people spoke about it. But, it's a powerful system of propaganda that we have, and we just fall prey to all these illusions about Obama. So, anyway, I don't know if we have any callers on the line. Let me see here. Wait a second. Somebody there? Hello? Well, apparently not. Are you there? Oh, this is Charchi, right? Charchi, yeah. Is that you? Okay.
I think so.
All right. If J.R. Pig or somebody else shows up, I guess I'll know that it's the second caller, because you're on the first, right? You're the first one on the list.
So, yeah.
Okay. Wait. Anyway, so another interesting thing having to do with all this propaganda that we're fed about Obama has to do with the sort of like the denial of responsibility about, you know, our system where you have some sort of choice. My liberal friend, whom I spend a lot of time with, he always tells me, oh, well, you know, you have a choice. You know, you have a choice, and therefore, if you have a choice, then somehow the people who are trying to propagandize you have no responsibility, and all the responsibility falls on your shoulders because you had a choice. I mean, that's sort of an either-or fallacy, because they're, you know, if you go to a restaurant, for example, and somebody poisons your food, right? It's true, you have a choice to take that food to the lab before you eat it, you know, or have a lab technician right near you to analyze the food and see if it's actually, if it has poison in before you eat it, right? I mean, or you could walk around with a helmet on 24 hours a day to make sure that something doesn't fall on your head and kills you. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things you can do, but you have the choice to do those things. But as things become more difficult, as the framework in which you function becomes, makes certain options easier to pursue, then the likelihood you'll do something diminishes. So we have to understand that even though, you know, it's not the same as somebody putting a gun to your head and saying, do this. Persuasion, making certain options easier to pursue and others harder to pursue, that sort of a middle-of-the-road sort of strategy of control that actually works as well, if not better, than outright coercion. You know, outright coercion works pretty good, but sometimes people can rebel against it in ways that it's harder to do under a powerful propaganda system. So I get sick of my liberal friend always saying the same things. You know, you have a choice, you have a choice. The harder something is, the less responsibility you have for not pursuing that path. That's a very simple principle. Something's easy to do. If it's easy for me to help you out, and I don't, there's more responsibility to that than if it's really hard for me to help you out and I don't, okay? That's sort of a very straightforward moral principle. And, it's funny. Today I went to here in San Francisco. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the city, but there's a famous spot. It's called Market and Powell, and, I went there because I wanted to see if I could sell some of my DVDs, and apparently it's not a very good place to advertise something like that. But anyway, I spoke to a few people there, and there were two girls from Seattle, you know, and they looked like they were in their 20s, maybe 26, 28. And so we were talking, and one of them had a tattoo, and I asked them, well, what is that tattoo? And she said, well, it's a sentence from the American anthem, what's the name of it, whatever it is, you know, one of the anthem of the United States, just has all those words. So I thought, oh, this girl must be pretty patriotic, nationalistic or whatever. But I asked her, just out of curiosity, well, are you familiar with the battle in Seattle? Because she's from Seattle. The battle in Seattle 99. There was even a movie made about it. Which, I, by the way, I haven't seen, but my friend Charnchi said that it wasn't all that radical. But these girls didn't know. These girls didn't know what the battle in Seattle was. So, isn't that amazing that you are from Seattle? You've lived in Seattle your whole life, and you even lived through the battle in Seattle. These girls were in their late 20s. It's like they were old enough to at least read about it or something. They had no clue. I mean, both of them. It's amazing. And so the propaganda that we're exposed to, I mean, should never be underestimated. This is a constant flow of misinformation, and you know, even us activists, it's just, I'm surprised. It's just a constant battle against all this garbage. It's just amazing. Anyway, so I think we have someone on the line. Maybe it's Joey. Let's see if we can actually. Joey, are you there?
Hey, Jonathan. Yeah, it's me.
Hey, how's it going, man? I think it's the first time I talked to you. Did you call last week to talk to David? Because last week I couldn't make it myself, and David was conducting the show.
Yeah, David and I hung out last week.
So what did you guys talk about?
Oh, geez. Well, he watched a movie called The Hurt Locker, and he was talking about how it basically just falls into the typical sort of colonialist discourse that doesn't take into account, you know, the people that the West sort of colonizes and takes over and stuff. And he was upset that it was such a highly rated movie, even though, you know, it's basically, you know, the same old rehashed colonialist story. So we talked about that for a while, and I brought up the issue of, like, us being more self-reflective, taking a moment like that to be self-reflective about our own, you know, sort of positions and the implications of our own sort of radical milieu. And then we, and then I brought up a very cool play. I mean, toward the end, I just brought up, it's called Insurgent Theater.
Uh-huh.
And they just went through, they did a round through the Midwest, and they hit the Northeast in the last couple of days. So they hit New York and Boston the last couple of days. I just talked about that, tried to plug that a little bit, because it's basically a two-man play. A girl and a guy do a play, and it's pretty cool. So I figured I'd plug that play.
Are you a student or like, where do you live?
I live in Columbus.
Ohio?
I guess I'm a student, also a teacher. Yeah, Ohio. Yeah, I'm at,
I don't know why, you know, I always had the impression that you were pretty young, and actually your voice sounds like, if you're a teacher, I suppose you're a little bit older than what your voice sounds.
Yeah, I'm 33.
33, okay.
I'm a PhD candidate, so I'm working on my dissertation right now. I haven't taught for a year or two now, just trying to write. But I've gotten involved in our info shop here lately, which is really cool, because it gives me a lot of access to a lot of cool literature and stuff. So,
what's your degree on?
Oh, it's in English.
Oh,
I'm
okay.
I'm writing a dissertation on medieval lit. Basically, politics, theology, economics, that sort of stuff.
You know, it's pretty interesting.
My field is medieval lit, medieval lit and critical theory and philosophy, that sort of stuff.
Well, maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, I don't know if you are aware that for the past few years I've been working on an article on Wikipedia. It's called Wage Slavery, and one of the things that...
Yeah, I'm very aware of it.
Yeah, we were talking about serfs and how there were at least, you know, about three different types of serfs. And I'm wondering if you could maybe talk about serfs and some of the similarities and dissimilarities that they have with wage slaves or, you know, however you want to call them. Do you think that there are some sort of similarities there, or what?
Well, we have to keep in mind lots of things. We have to keep in mind two very important things. Every anarchist should understand this. But basically, the Middle Ages were a pre-state and pre-capitalist time, okay? And by state, I mean like what we would imagine as a nation state. There were quite a few interlocking systems of loyalty, which we call fealty. You guys may have, people may have heard of that before. Systems of fealty, which underpinned feudalism, and so that really sort of mitigated the quote unquote monopoly of coercive force over a territory. And in that sense, the church and the feudal lords were constantly at odds over who, and constantly negotiating who had the right to determine X, Y, and Z in a certain territory. So it was far more Wild Westy, I guess, than what we're accustomed to as far as what the nation state is now. And economically, a similar thing happened. Although, like you said, there's different types of serfs. And as the Middle Ages got on, you know, we started to see the growth of what would basically be called like proto-capitalists as far as like merchants and traders and that sort of thing. There's quite a misnomer about the Middle Ages being this very sort of insulated time in Europe. There was actually quite a bit of trade going around all of Europe, but especially around the Mediterranean. So it was not, you know, quite the same thing. But yeah, your article on wage slavery does a good job of just laying out, you know, that sort of stuff.
It's like in our latest discussion, we were trying to figure out what is it that makes wage labor different from other forms of subordination.
Right.
I was basically saying, well, it's not merely classes, because you had classes in monarchy, you had classes in feudalism, and it's not merely exploitation, because obviously all those things lead to exploitation, and it's not merely wages, because apparently some serfs also worked for wages to some, you know, a little bit, and
they did.
So it's my conclusion was that it was the extent to which a wage laborer depends on wages for survival, and the extent to which that contributes to the perpetuation and to the strength of a different set of people, namely a set of a class of capitalists.
I think you're spot on in that discussion as far as that sort of stuff goes. There's other things going on in feudalism that help keep the system. Help keep the integrity of the system. Here, I mean, when we're talking about wage slavery, it's a pretty sort of abstract economic exchange, quote-unquote voluntary, when we all, of course, know that it's not as most fundamental. But in the Middle Ages, like I was saying a second ago, there was very much other things keeping sort of the serfs in their situation. And I always have to guard against sort of romanticizing the Middle Ages, because I am a medievalist, so I tend to like that stuff. But it was oppressive. It just, I think, probably had a wider variety, okay, of systems of subordination. So when we're thinking about that, you know, you've got systems of like I said, loyalty, which in the noble caste would come through an oath of fealty. But even serfs basically were tied to the land, tied to the noble, et cetera. And basically, they were pretty much mentally conditioned to accept their subordination to, you know, to the lords. But by the same token, while you had that sort of thing going on, I think anyways, and I think lots of medieval scholars would agree with me that the systems of social responsibility amongst the different classes were probably closer linked. It was a closer knit type of community. So the obligations that the serfs had, the obligations that the lords had, the obligations that the clergy had, all these other the classes, I mean, we think of the three estates, right?
Right.
Their obligations to each other were probably closer knit than they are now.
Because I think that Chomsky put it bluntly, but maybe lucidly, when he said that it's sort of like when the development of wage labor and the market and so on meant that you didn't really have a right to live. It's sort of like maybe the medieval relationship is more paternal, right?
It very much was. It was it's definitely more paternal. I don't know, because like capitalists love to play up their paternalism, and we hear that in their rhetoric all the time. I'd say that there was far more of an emphasis on the interdependency of the different classes, okay, and the different classes' responsibility to each other, their obligations to each other, and it was built up, you know, not so much through. I mean, basically what we have is basically just through economics, just through capital, just through the state that we have our interdependency. Their interdependency was far more complex than that. And so,
right. I mean, you had like certain...
It was a different system and more comprehensive. It was very, very much more difficult to tear feudalism apart than I think to really get at it, pick at it, et cetera. Than it is capitalism and the state as well. So,
well, the power of the church was also extremely powerful too, right? The influence of the church was tremendous.
Well, the influence of Christianity itself, sure, was definitely. But I think lots of times people play up too much the power of the centralized church in the Middle Ages. We have to keep in mind that there was a long period in church history in the Middle Ages where there were several popes. So, you know, it's important to sort of, you know, put nuances, okay, when we're talking about, you know, the church's influence as like this monolithic, centralized being, when it really, really wasn't, and didn't exert anywhere near the amount of centralizing control and influence as it may seem.
What is also interesting to me is that, you know, like today in our...
But Christianity, for sure.
What's that? Sorry?
You know, I'm saying, but Christianity itself, the religion itself, definitely. It was definitely much more of the sort of fabric of society. But, I mean, I'm just making the distinction between Christianity and the church, quote-unquote, you know.
What I think is interesting, too, is that... you know, today we have a lot of denial of class, especially in the United States, which is considered by many to be sort of the pinnacle of capitalism around the world. And we have all this denial of class. We're all a big, happy family. And do you, what's your, do you see any similarities? Or do you think that the roles, in the Middle Ages were, internalized by the people who form part of those classes? Like, we're serfs aware?
Definitely. They were definitely internalized. And completely subsumed. I mean, yeah, in our society now, we like to downplay, especially in America, we like to downplay the sort of class system. And I mean, and your movie does a good job of doing this whole like social harmony, you know, type of thing. But in the Middle Ages, they were highly aware of the class system. They were highly aware of it. And in many ways, they were extremely, I mean, for lack of a better word, they were happy with the class system itself.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I went to...
That's not to undermine the critique about, you know, its exploitative, oppressive, hierarchical nature, but it's just... Basically, you know,
revolts. I mean, like when I went to, for example, I was in Slovenia because my mother lives in Trieste, which is in the northeast of Italy. But we went to Slovenia and we went to a castle there and they were telling us about how there was this peasant revolt, which didn't succeed.
Oh, yeah.
But you know.
There were definitely uprisings from now and then, like... One of the watershed moments in the Middle Ages for England, and that's the country that I'm most familiar with, is the 1381 Peasants' Revolt, and that was huge. That had a huge effect on sort of the politics of England, the psyche of the English. So you see references to it. You see its repercussions in Chaucer and Langland. You know, pretty much everywhere. In the 14th century, late 14th century, early 15th century. And then once you get into the 15th century in England, the whole system starts to dissolve. The whole system of fealty starts to dissolve. The whole system of basically aristocratic rule starts to dissolve when you get into England and you see stuff like the War of the Roses, which basically occupied the entire 15th century. So yeah, there was, it was definitely, you know, bubbling up, et cetera.
That was the rise of the bourgeoisie?
Say what?
Like what dissolved the feudal structures, was that the rise of the bourgeoisie, the rise of a merchant class?
That was definitely a part of it. But it fell under its own weight as well. I mean, eventually you get to a point where, just imagine if you have a bunch of, you know, private defense agencies. That's basically what a lord was, competing for the loyalty of each other, of the people, mm-hmm. et cetera. Eventually it's just going to devolve. And it did. Especially in England, just devolved into a mess, and it fell under its own weight, every bit as much as it did fall because of the rise of capitalism itself, and the proto bourgeoisie with the merchants and the traders.
Yeah,
and we have to keep in mind another thing. This is also, as later you get on in the Middle Ages, it's also the time when what we would think of now as like guilds. Guild and unions and those sorts of things,
uh-huh.
as well. So, I mean, there's lots of things that ended up converging to do in the systems that made the Middle Ages run. But
wait a second. You must have had guilds of merchants, right? Like merchants must have formed unions, yeah. and organizations in order to gather enough strength to overthrow the system.
An overthrow per se, as far as economics goes, it's more like it just sort
replacement of replacement over time.
Yeah, I think replacement's probably a better word. I mean, when I think of like an overthrow, I think of like, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution or something, where the economic system is completely overturned, etc. But this is not what happened. It was far more gradual evolution. And at some point, you know, the lords looked around, the petty gentry looked around. They were like, oh, my gosh, merchants, the guild people in the cities, they're more powerful than us. You know, they have more money than we do. And so that's basically what happened. I mean, the world changed, you know, pretty much without, you know, not many people understanding how it did or why it did, et cetera. So,
but we know what's interesting also is that later on, I mean, apparently from what I understand, what I read in E.P. Thompson's book about the working class in England, he talks about how syndicalism was not developed till the 18th century. And, in response to the introduction of, industrialization, wage labor, and so on.
Yep.
Yet these merchant associations, whatever you want to call them, unions or whatever, guilds. I mean, they existed for a long time, way before syndicalism ever arose.
Actually, if you go and read some of the early syndicalists, they will frequently make mention of the guild as early instantiation of what they're trying to do. But yeah, I mean, essentially, you know, you have what basically a union, like a chamber of commerce, far as what the guild sort of did and how they got together. And it exists to this day. I mean, those types of institutions still exist amongst the Catholic class. So they haven't gone anywhere. The response as industrialization started to get off the ground, as Thompson says, was for, obviously, the workers, the proletariat, to do the same thing. And since then, ever since then, both groups have been vying over control of the state, because we have to keep in mind, during the Middle Ages, there is nothing like what we have with the nation state. It was a very different situation. And so since when capitalism and the state come into existence, essentially in the 16th century, I'd say, as you start to see, like, these absolutist monarchs start to consolidate control over their countries, like King Henry VIII, for instance, you know, then you see, you know, the capitalist class start to, you know, take control of the machinations of the state, especially as you go into the 19th century. And then in the 19th century specifically, I mean, definitely it goes off. The workers start to organize, you know, basically socialist institutions to counterbalance it. And pretty much since the 19th century, maybe late 18th century, 19th century, the state has basically been in the middle of, you know, the struggle between the capitalists and the workers.
Another thing that I find interesting.
This come in your movie too. Yeah.
One thing that I find interesting is that is the change in the ideologies needed to maintain the hegemony of a class. So we know that in the Middle Ages, the church played a very important role in maintaining the sort of ideological glue of that society. And, you know, to a large extent, the church has lost a lot of its ability to do that today. In the United States, they certainly have a lot of influence. But, you know, other ideologies developed, consumerism and, you know, I mean, I'm sure
nationalism,
yeah, this is sort of a secular religion there. But I guess religion is still in the background. It's still, you know, it's always sort of been, at least, you know, the mainstream of the church, always been sort of at the service of the elite of whatever system they found themselves in.
Generally, yeah. And I don't know. I think that our societies now have a far healthier engagement with religion as a sort of as a possible political player than in the past, for sure. I just think now, like, yes, it's in the background and it sort of informs, you know, what some people sort of think about politics, et cetera, but it's not able to wield the actual power that it has in the past. And so it basically serves a suasive function now. I mean, it's basically the equivalent of, you know, us talking about stuff, you know, to the amount of influence it can bring to bear. It's just more healthy, you know, than I think it was.
To change subject here a little bit, I'd like to ask you, because, you know, what Charnchi and I, we were talking about primitivism and we do tend to agree on some of the premises of primitivism more than, say, Dave, in the sense that it's not that we're primitivists, but we do agree on a lot of the ideas that come out of, you know, books of people like John Tirzan and others about the sort of the change towards civilization, sort of almost inevitably led to some of the hierarchical forms that we see today. But on the other hand, syndicalists and other radical groups have seen a much better potential to achieve a satisfactory society within the framework of civilization. As you know, I always talk about that even people who are diehard primitivists, they still need a transitional period, which would have to be something like anarcho-syndicalism in order to be at all a libertarian revolution. But what's your take on the whole primitivist, point of view?
It's difficult for me to really... Let's see. I would say... that at its extent, okay, I think it's dangerous. I think there's definitely some bizarre hopelessness that underlies their views on the potential for quote unquote civilization. And I use that because they would use it as well. So, when I see some of the crazier stuff that Zerzan's talked about, I find it sort of dangerous. I think it's...
It's sort of an all or nothing attitude. I mean, I personally feel like they say, you know, they just sort of give up on any anything, any compromise, and yeah. You know, the sort of like, it's like people who attack me for supporting universal healthcare. You know, it's sort of like they you know, I personally, of course, that we have to stop the destruction of the planet. Of course, that we have to return to a more natural and less alienated form of society.
I think we can do a lot of what the primitivists want, if we can basically reverse capitalism. I mean, if we strike at capitalism, I think that lots of the outcomes they want will end up coming to fruition, in the sense that I think we'd end up having a far more engaged and healthy relationship with our environment than we do under capitalism, especially late global capitalism. I mean, something I've been reading up lately on is the sort of local food movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, that's all sorts of good stuff there. One of the major thing holding it back from actually unfolding to, I think, its full bloom is, of course, capitalism itself. Just because it makes it very hard for, almost impossible to set up sort of competitive, in a capitalist sense, local food markets, et cetera. But, again, I mean, I think, you know, striking at the... at the root would get us far closer to what they want. And then I think that, I think their hopelessness in civilization, quote unquote, again, would subside, you know, once they saw the effects that, you know, rolling capitalism back would have. And I think one of those effects would be to give us a far closer engagement with our specific local environments. I think that lots of times the exploitation of the environment is sort of compelled, mandated by capital and the state. So I think if people yep. sort of...
I agree with you, man.
You know, if people, you know, would strike at those two roots, then, you know, I think... I find it hard to believe, for instance, that a local community would be like to a big agribusiness. In you know, in the absence of state and capital and their controls, oh yeah, huge, you know, 10,000 head of cattle farm. Please come in here with your big industrial, you know, farm system where all the cows are on top of each other, producing mounds and mounds of manure a year that get washed into our stream that we're supposed to drink out of. I find it very hard to believe. Okay, that a local community would let that happen.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, thanks very much for calling, Joey. We have another caller on the line, so I'm going to let you go here.
Okay, cool.
But hopefully you can call next show. That would be great, man.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we'll see. If there's something to say, then I might call in.
All right.
All right.
Talk to you later, man.
Bye.
All right.
Yeah, bye.
Okay, so we have another caller in the line. I guess we didn't have time for a break. I was going to take a little music break. Maybe we'll do that later. Are you on the line, Myrtles? Myrtles, are you there? Well, I guess he's not there, so we're going to go to a music break, and maybe he'll come back later. All right.
Stop, stop, stop. Head up, head up. Why are we angry? I say, look at history. The cause of our troubles, it is not a mystery. There are those whose lives are easy, there are those whose lives are rough. Now is the time for us to rise and cry out about the stop-free politicians, and of gender role traditions, and of hierarchies, and of those living on our knees, and of doubting and of planet, the destruction of the Earth, and the scaling of her flesh, which she decides on for. We won't take it anymore. Yeah, this is class war. Like you in the street, we will dance and join the street. Yeah, basta! Let me hear you say it again. Yeah, basta! You can do louder than that. Come on. Yeah, basta! Yeah, basta! Where do you know be a day when the melting pot will boil? You only bring us closer before you make for oil. Union that you break, and spell it box you sunk. Bring us closer to the day we will cry out. Enough is enough! I got tired for that one. Enough is enough. There's so many things that it's enough of, that part. Huh? Borders, yeah, that's it.
Anyway, so that was Ya Basta. And I guess we're going to just keep on, you know, reporting some of the awful news out there. And unfortunately, haven't heard of much good news out there. We keep hearing about the threats to Iran, but those somehow never, you know, end up in a war. You never know, you know. It's like one of these days we'll hear about an all-out attack or something. And, of course, we hear about the recession being over from Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve. But other economists say that it's actually just the prelude to something much worse. And I tend to agree with the economists who say that because... I don't think that the measures that were taken, I mean, you know, and for anyone who really wants to learn about these issues, I would suggest reading the Anarchist FAQ Section C on the myths of capitalist economics, because most people, I mean, for example, the Austrians, they believe that it's the state intervention in the economy which causes the business cycle and the slumps, the ups and downs of capitalism. But if you look at the point of view that is put forth in the Anarchist FAQ, you'll see that that there's a lot of evidence against that point of view, and that in fact capitalism has an inherent tendency to go up and down, to have these bubbles and, you know, burst a lot of it, by the way, has to do with the class struggle, with social struggle. As the working class gets too strong or too weak, that's a very strong factor in determining, you know, the balance of power, the aggregate demand in the economy. Workers have more power; they can demand higher wages, and that means that they can consume more. But that also means that the capitalists lose power and money to the workers. I mean, ultimately, capitalism, folks, we have to understand, it's a system of global exploitation. So it's true that, you know, the workers are also consumers. But let's not forget about this, that you know, there is a global class of rich people who have to accumulate wealth. And that's how they become capitalists. And by the way, that's another reason why all these assumptions that we are taught in economics class are wrong. Like, for example, the assumption that you the reason why you can they say that the reason why you ask for a loan, or because, you know, or why you buy something, is because you prefer to buy it now, not later, or you prefer to buy it later, not now. No, folks, a capitalist is not making profit to spend the money later. That's not his motivation. He's accumulating money because that's the nature of capitalism. If capitalists spent all their money on donuts, okay, if say Bill Gates bought 1,000 donuts because he loves donuts, you know, he's not going to be a capitalist anymore, because all the money will be spent on stuff that is not has nothing to do with the with the business of capitalism. Capitalism is about accumulating wealth just for the sake of doing that. Because, I mean, this is what you need to survive as a capitalist as well. You don't survive as a capitalist if you don't have any capital. I mean, that's just... but, yet, you know, all these things... I mean, I had this German girlfriend over for about a week. And she's taking this economic class. Her major is, like, business. So... And we were talking about the demand curve, you know, the famous demand curve, the indifference curve, and how they say, well, you know, they say that an additional, like let's say that you want ice cream, says, you know, how much are you willing to pay for that extra cone of ice cream? That's the marginal utility of that cone of ice cream, and that's that, and that determines the price. And that's nonsense because, first of all, price is a factor in determining whether or not you want the ice cream, okay? When you go buy ice cream, the first thing you look at is how much does it cost, right? So it's not your subjective evaluation of, an additional cone of ice cream. The price plays a very important role. And, you know, you can't... I mean, I have a good video about this, in my channel, you know, I talk about how subjective evaluations cannot possibly account for the way corporations and other capitalist institutions set prices. It's just it's a logical impossibility. It's an illusion they teach you in economics class to make it seem like capitalism is voluntary. You know, just and to forget about the fact that prices that the working class and their struggle against capital, plays an important role in determining price, especially in the long term. So they want you to forget about that and just focus on something that's not going to be critical of capitalism. So we have Tyler who wants to talk on the show. So let me see. Are you there, Tyler?
Hey.
Hey, how's it going, man? How's it going, man?
Good. This is the first time I ever talked on the show. I mean, I haven't really got much to say. You know, I haven't really thought of a question or anything.
That's good. But don't get too close to the microphone. That's better. Go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, so you were talking about primitivism. Sort of reminds me of... you know, the whole lifestyle anarchist thing. Some people say it's like a total kind of waste of energy to do the lifestyle anarchism thing. What do you think about it?
What do you mean by lifestyle anarchism? Because people have
trying to change your lifestyle, you know, so it's less reliant on capitalism per se. Like, say, you know, trying to live up to your ideals and your life instead of trying to conform to the system.
Well, I mean, I don't think it hurts. I mean, you know, sort of like if you, you know, but once again, you know, we don't want to fall into the fallacy of paying attention to concern. I mean, ultimately, you can't really help contributing to the system. Wherever you are in the system, yeah. You know, whether you're an engineer or you work at Starbucks, you directly or indirectly contribute to the system. And yeah, it's good to sort of like, you know, not be just not consume like a monster. Just you can certainly cut down on all consumption and I mean, just for your own. Because after all, you need to acquire some self-control. I mean, I think we all need to, and that may contribute to that. But I mean, ultimately, it is the institutions which in my view play a more important role in influencing people's behavior. So I mean,
like you don't think if everyone just says, well, we're gonna stop driving cars, that's going to make a huge difference.
Oh, sure. I mean, look, if but But the problem with that is that it's very hard to pursue within our current framework. So I'm saying that actually efforts in that direction are positive. I'm not, people who actually do that, I support them 100%. I mean, I don't drive a car, and actually I've never even had a cell phone. Yeah. You know, I'm pretty a techie guy. I mean, I have computer and a lot of microphones and cameras, but I try to cut down on, but say in the United States, for example, if you live in the United States, unless you live in a city like San Francisco that has good public transportation, you know, how are you going to get to places, you know, how are you going to get to work?
Yeah.
The system makes it hard to pursue, and that's what it is that, so I think it's a little bit of both, but it's mostly sort of changing the system, changing policy and collective action. People who talk about, you know, being against some of the actions that right now are, you know, being carried out by the state because we don't have a better framework that with which we can actually affect certain large scale decisions like say healthcare or public transportation or whatever. They have to understand that it's a process. You know, it's not. You know, and in that process, certainly lifestyle anarchism can contribute. I mean, do you find yourself, for example, feeling better about yourself when you try to cut down on some of the excesses of our capitalist society, or do you feel like?
I mean, the only time I ever really changed my lifestyle was I was a vegetarian for a few months. And I'm not anymore, but like I did it because I read about, you know, what it was doing to the environment. And, I felt good about myself for those few months. And then I sort of fell back into the old patterns. So, you know, I mean, it's sort of.
Well, I mean, just think about this. Really, I mean, because I've thought seriously about vegetarianism, too, and it's tough because where I live, like I get three meals a day. I've been here for 10 years. I have rent control, so I don't want to move out. And I get all these, and it's hard for me not to, because they always serve meat. But see, if you lived in an environment, you know, where you had a big diner, you know, anarchist diner where everybody went in, and you had a lot of good vegetarian food, you probably, you know, a lot of us who eat meat might start shifting toward vegetarianism. But because the society as a whole has that sort of emphasis, it's pretty hard.
Yeah, I mean, and it's sort of like, you know, sometimes there just isn't like other, like, you know, just good vegetarian food around, like you said. So, you know, it's sort of a hard choice to make sometimes if you don't have other people supporting you. Exactly. So, yeah.
Are you a student, Tyler, or what do you do?
Yeah, I'm a student. Actually, I'm a student in political science.
Okay.
So, you know, and lots of things are, and one thing about political science is they don't really talk too much about anarchism, and so in a way they sort of treat it like it doesn't exist. But you know, people outside of program, they talk about it. Like I know some activists, they all have all the literature from it. In fact, I went to
90 seconds
and they had all these buttons. Some said the IWW on it, and I said, where'd you get all these buttons? And it's like, well, we went down to the anarchist book fair in New York. So I thought it was pretty cool, because you know, Buttigieg did a bunch of videos about that.
Yep, he did.
Think.
Cool, yeah. Man. Well, we're running out of time here, so I gotta kick you out here. But
60 seconds.
Thanks for calling in, man. And if you want, just call in next week, because we appreciate callers and people who are engaged.
All right.
Thanks, man.
Okay. See ya.
All right, bye-bye, folks. So that's the end of it, and I want to play a song, and. That's the end of the show. So see you next week, and hopefully we can get David here next week.
That's cool. I forgot to talk to myself.
10 seconds.
Be all alone.